We'll commence in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. For the week of June 8th, 2007, this is the Rain Report, Ham Radio's audio internet magazine. I'm Blair Alper, KA9SEQ. This week, we bring you the third of 5 excerpts from the recently completed 2007 Dayton Hamvention FCC Forum. During the first 2 weeks of this series, we heard from Riley Hollingsworth, K4ZDH, Special Counsel for Amateur Enforcement with the FCC. This time, we turn to William Cross, W3TN, who works in the Mobility Division of the FCC's Wireless Communications Bureau. So what's that all about? Here's William Cross to explain.
This is the office in the FCC that is responsible for oversight of the amateur radio service. The service used to be in a group called the Public Safety and Critical Infrastructure Division, but after a reorganization, the public safety part of that division and some other groups became our Homeland Security Bureau. And there were a handful of us, about 9, that worked on services that weren't really public safety, they weren't broadband, they weren't some of the other services. We became part of the Mobility Division. And that was kind of interesting because the Mobility Division is primarily cellular. They didn't really know what to do with these guys that deal with aviation and marine radio service and ham radio. What's this all about? It's been kind of an interesting blending of different areas within the commission, but the interesting thing was that after the amateur service was in the Mobility Division, the guys that worked in the division that were hams started to admit it. I couldn't understand why, but they did. Suddenly, their division chief, who is now my division chief, found out he had hams all around him. And for me, this was safety. For him, it was terror beyond belief. It has worked out well, and for the most part, it hasn't been a lot of changes other than just the sign outside the door. That's where we are now. We're in the Mobility Division. In the Mobility Division, we handle the day-to-day administration of the amateur radio service and some of the rulemaking activities that affect the amateur radio service. Our division also has staff in our Gettysburg office. The Gettysburg staff handles most of your applications. They handle licensing matters, and it deals with the Universal Licensing System, or ULS as it is known. The amateur radio service is affected by other bureaus in the commission, too. Our Office of Engineering and Technology handles spectrum allocation and equipment issues. Our Managing Director's Office handles matters related to fees for vanity call signs and Debt Collection Improvement Act matters, such as the federal registration numbers and all that other stuff. I want to talk about two kind of different areas that I hope are of interest to you. First, I want to talk about proceedings where the commission has issued a decision and the rule changes that have become effective. And then secondly, I want to let you know what's kind of pending before the commission. These are rulemaking requests that have been filed, other matters that we have received and will have to take action on, which have not been resolved yet. The major commission decisions that have been made since I was here last are the report and order in docket 04140. This is commonly referred to as the phone band expansion proceeding, and these rule changes became effective December 15th of last year. The report and order in docket WT05235, this is the no-code proceeding, was also released since I was here last, and these rule changes became effective February 23rd. And then we had a bureau order that came out in 2006 that implemented certain changes that were adopted in the World Radio Conference final acts. So I'm going to talk about these and just summarize for you briefly what they were. Much of this has already been put in one form or another on other websites, so you may have an idea of parts of it, or you may have be familiar with the part that affected you, but not the overall decision, and so you'll get to hear the overall thing from me. The one that had the most rule changes and probably affects most of you is the report and order in 04140. As I mentioned, it's usually called the phone band expansion proceeding, but the decision actually has a much greater impact than just authorizing more frequencies for phone operation. It was a decision that resolved 20 petitions for rulemaking. The main rule changes in there were that it kind of restructured your bands in the HF part. It eliminated the novice and the technician plus class telephony bands, and it used some of that spectrum to expand the bands for phone operation in 80 and 40 meters. There was a change in that decision to the general class phone band in 15 meters. The general class licensees got an additional 25 kilohertz of spectrum there for phone operation, but the overall size of the 15 meter band remained the same. It was phone operation 21.2 and above. The decision also authorized Novice and Technician Plus class licensees CW privileges in what you all refer to as the General and Advanced class CW bands, and it gave them CW and Iridian data privileges in 28.0 to 28.3 megahertz. Another big change that occurred in that decision was that it allowed licensees in the Vanity call sign system to express their desire as to which radio club receives their call sign in memorandum. The rule previously had allowed any relative of yours, including ones that you didn't even know and ones you didn't like, think about that, the ultimate revenge, to decide which radio club got your call sign. But the rule didn't allow the licensee, the person with the most interest in where their call sign goes, to express a preference. So we were requested to change that rule, and we did. Now, what this means is that if someone wants their call sign to go to a particular radio club after they pass away, they can indicate that by a letter or some other document to the club. And then after you pass away, the trustee of the club station can come in and apply for your call sign and say, I have this documentation that expresses that, the view of the licensee. It doesn't mean your call sign automatically goes to that club. The club still has to apply for it, and they may look at your call sign and say, we don't want this. They have to be first, just as they do under the system now. So if someone else, such as a former holder or a relative of a former holder, comes in before the club, they're going to get it. But it does allow you to express a view. We also made a change to the Vanity call sign system to resolve something that had really bugged you, and this was the multiple applications. It was strictly a 1x2 problem, as we all know, and you had requested that we change that rule so that an applicant could only file one application for a Vanity call sign. And we did. Now, only the first application we receive is considered. So if someone files 20 applications, the first one in ULS is considered, the other 19 are dismissed. They only have one chance to get that. It has certainly cut down on the number of applications for call signs when they become available, and from what I've heard, it certainly has restored what you all think of as a fairer system, instead of people filing hundreds of applications for a particular call sign. It won't solve all of the problems, but it will solve the gaming of the system by essentially someone just filing, reams of applications and then getting their money back for all the ones that were dismissed.
You're listening to the first of three excerpts from a 2007 Dayton Hamvention presentation by FCC employee William Cross, W3TN. We'll continue his FCC forum talk in a moment. This is The Rain Report, which updates Fridays at therainreport.com and telephonically at 773-249-0720.
There is another change in here that also is going to help you a little bit if you do HF operation, and that was a change in the amplifier rules. It used to be that amplifiers could not be approved from a manufacturer if they had the capability of transmitting on the 12 and the 10 meter bands. So what the manufacturer did was they sold you a bunch of parts that were the input coil, the strap from the tuning coil. They included a little thing about how to take the block out of the switch. And then you would take the amplifier, if you weren't capable of doing it yourself, you'd take it to a friend in the neighborhood that modified amplifiers for everyone else. And lo and behold, your amplifier now transmitted on 10 and 12 meters. Commercial manufacturers could not sell them if it had that capability. In the process of simplifying rules and streamlining them and, kind of getting rid of unnecessary rules, that rule was changed so that now it is a much simpler rule. Hopefully it is understandable, because I couldn't understand the old one. The rule provides that a commercial manufacturer can receive type acceptance for an amplifier as long as it does not transmit on a very narrow frequency range, which includes the CB band. You now can buy them out of the box, off the shelf, that include 10 and 12 meters. Other rule changes in that decision included allowing the station to transmit an image emission 500 cycles or less on the data and RIDI frequency segments. This basically allowed some of the modulation systems that had already been developed and were already in use to be now under the rules, because they were transmitting an image emission, like a fax emission. We allowed auxiliary stations These are stations that are used for repeaters and remote bases and other control links and that kind of thing to transmit on certain parts of the 2-meter band. Licensees that are interested in spread spectrum communications were authorized to use the 222 to 225 megahertz band as well as the higher frequencies. And there are a few stations around that enjoy retransmitting communications from spacecraft. The rules had provided that they could retransmit communications from the space shuttle. The question had been, well, what about the International Space Station? This isn't a shuttle in that it's kind of not planned on coming down. So we looked at the rule, and it was more of a clarification that the International Space Station had gone up since the original rule had been written. We clarified it now so that you can retransmit communications between a manned spacecraft and its associated Earth stations. A lot of you are interested in emergency communications. If the president declares a communications emergency, communications are going to be authorized under Part 214 of our rules, not Part 97 anymore. What Part 214 says, if we end up in a situation like that, it's going to be the director of the Office of Science and Telecommunications Policy in the White House that decides who transmits, what frequencies they transmit, what they can transmit, and that is where responsibility for communications is going to be centralized in OSTP. And the commission will work with the director of OSTP. But this rule here that says that just, you know, categorically authorized people to transmit in certain frequency segments, I guess the polite way to say it would be that it's been overcome by events. And so that frequency segment was deleted, and a reference was made to what you'll be doing is will be under Part 214 of the rules in the RACES segment. And then we also made a few administrative changes to rules in the examination system. Mostly this affected the volunteer examiners and the volunteer examiner coordinators, and not so much the people taking examinations. The more recent rulemaking that came out was the report and order in the no-code proceeding. This is sometimes called the no-code proceeding because it's that darn 5-word-per-minute code test that received all the attention. But the decision also de facto, and I want you to know I got that word from a lawyer because I don't speak Italian, restructured the license classes because it changed the privileges for a couple 100,000 licensees. This decision resolved 18 petitions for rulemaking that we had, and the requests, as most of you are aware, were pretty much based on the rule changes that were adopted to the international radio regulations at the World Radio Conference in 2003. The two major rule changes were that it eliminated the Morse code requirement for the Technician Plus, the General, and the Amateur Extra Class Operator licenses, and it authorized Technician Class licensees the same HF operating privileges that Novice and Technician Plus class licensees have. When the rule first came out, it was amazing to hear some of the stuff on the air to the effect of, well, I haven't read it, but I know all the technicians were automatically upgraded to general. I'm sitting there listening to that and said, well, I have read that, and I don't know that. This all sorted itself out over the course of a couple of weeks, and the ARRL put a frequently asked question page on their website that was absolutely fabulous. The fellow that helped with that, and I'm sure worked night and day to get that out, was Dan Henderson at the ARRL. There were many phone calls and many emails back and forth to get answers to questions that they were getting bombarded with, I was getting bombarded with, and we decided the only way any of us were going to survive this was to put out an FAQ. They put it on their website. It had tables in it of the frequencies that people were authorized to use. It clarified there were no automatic upgrades, there were no changes to the privileges for the upper class licensees, and immediately the phone calls ceased. The information does get out there, and it really gets out there quite quickly. If you look beyond just the commission's website, which can be sometimes pretty dry and pretty perfunctory, we did not automatically upgrade anyone's license class or change the operating privileges for any of the license classes. Remember, the novice and the technician class licensees, their operating privileges were changed in the previous docket. They were changed in the fall when they got the general and the advanced class CW bands. We did authorize the technician class licensees, and these were primarily the people without credit for a code test, same privileges novice and technician class licensees had. As a practical matter, what this meant was they could use 10-meter phone, and they could use the data privileges on 10 meters. The no-code technicians were probably not going to show up in the CW bands. The other thing was many technician class licensees that had passed the code test previously, they didn't even realize they had those privileges, and they did.
That was William Cross, W3TN, who works in the Mobility Division of the FCC's Wireless Communications Bureau. We'll continue his talk, given during the FCC Forum at the 2007 Dayton Hamvention next time. The RAIN Report is copyright 1990 through 2007 RAIN, all rights reserved. Now for RAIN's founder-producer, Hap Holly, KC9RP, I'm Blair Alper, KA9SEQ, bidding you very 73 from all of us at RAIN, the Radio Amateur Information Network.